Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. I'm Ailey Packham and we are pottering about thanks to oldfootballshirts.com. Well, it was with a sense of frustration that the masses left the Amex last Saturday, not because of the performance, because that was great, but because of the joy stealers at Stockley Park. It's going to take a little bit of a while to get used to VAR. So, today we welcome Southampton to the Amex, who have yet to get a point on the board this season, so we'll be hungry to put that right. We, on the other hand, are in a very different proposition from last season, and after last week's performance, we will want to record our first win, home win of the season. Also, this week we said goodbye and thanks to Tom Mohamed, whose protracted transfer to join Berankaya Charlton finally went through, and it was officially confirmed that Brighton will be one of the host cities for the Women's Euros in 2021. Joining me today is, of course, Alan Willis, and we are delighted to welcome back the First Lady of the Roar. It's Vicky Rees. Just let that hang for
What's
a minute.
What's her name?
Vicky Rees.
Okay, well done.
Thank
yeah.
you. And we also welcome back the chairman of Seagulls Over London. It's Russell Guyver. And we also have an interloper as unadvertised. We welcome back Matthew Potter. Good morning, good morning, good
Hello.
Morning.
Good morning.
Unadvertised, but unadvertised, but very welcome. And as for the two advertised people, Mrs. Rees and Mr. Guyver, welcome back. How are we?
Very well,
hot.
Thanks.
It's a bit warm. It's a bit warm in here, yeah. And I mean, it's. So, how are you finding the start of the season, Vicky?
It's been really positive. In terms of the football, anyway, I thought that the performance against West Ham was probably better than the performance at Watford, actually. And it's exactly what Potter said after the first week, isn't it? That we'll probably play better and not win, or lose, he said. But we'll probably play better and not win at times. And that kind of came to pass. It was pleasing with the performance, but slightly disappointing with the result. Yeah.
And what does Potter say in the corner?
Well, I go along with Vicky there. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed us away at Watford. But West Ham were a better team. We were unlucky. We had plenty of chances. It was all positive.
I was going to say, Russell, I mean, it must be sort of grating that considering what we put up with through 2019 so far, that the thing that we're complaining about most after the West Ham game is just how wasteful we were in front of goal.
Yes, it's an irony, isn't it, really? I mean, considering how well we played as well, we've created the chances to squander them and then have that to worry about. I suppose it's a different complaint. We can't be too disappointed with,
but,
I suppose,
but
in a way.
It was the manner of the performance, Russ, and the energy, and yeah. I mean, we're going to talk about the game in a bit, but we've seen this new style of play, and the frustration for me is that this is largely the same personnel as last year. Obviously Potter's come in with new ideas and refreshed the ideals, and the players are actually buying into it, but it is the same personnel.
But yeah, but you can't help thinking that the way that the acquisition team works, those that were sought to find the players in question, is that they probably found the right players, but it was kind of square pegs and round holes. And the way that Houghton decided not to change his system and basically had what he had, you know, it was stick or twist, and he definitely stuck. Dear God, did he stick. But with the players we've got, they suited a different system. What that was, we weren't 100% sure until Graham Potter turned up, and you realise that they are actually a team that actually really suits that style.
Yeah. Well, Matt, you were particularly critical of Chris Houghton towards the end.
I think I was particularly critical.
And then we're not going to start you on Jurgen Locadia just yet.
Al's point about banging square pegs into round holes is absolutely true. I agree that Houghton was trying to, you know, do things with players who weren't suited to it. But I also think we shouldn't get ahead of ourselves. We've played two games like this. The other teams in the league haven't had a chance to sort it to suss us out yet. Mm. When they do suss us out, it'll be a different thing. It'll be whether we can still play this way and impose our style on other teams.
Now, Vicky, though, you're married to a Swansea fan, so whose name is also Rees. Sorry, in joke there. I always get a name
wrong.
Yeah,
no more in jokes, please.
I know, but it's obviously with Swansea last year, obviously it was only there for a short time, but he had a plan A, B, and C. So when plan A didn't work, he moved to a different thing. So as Matt says, we could, under this particular style, this 3-5-2.
3-4-3.
3-5. Yeah, whatever the formation is.
Wait, did you get to see Swansea last year?
only really on TV. I think what you said, I think I would qualify it a little bit, and that Swansea had a very good home record, but they did get battered in several games as well. They, you know, there was a game away at QPR. QPR are a terrible side, and they went and lost 4-0. I think, you know, so they, when you say he has a plan A, B and C, yeah, he certainly looks capable of changing things. He certainly, you know, changed things around from what we had last season. I wonder if, you know, firstly, we've only played in the nicest possible way. Well, not only two games, but also two games against Watford and West Ham, who aren't, no matter what West Ham fans seem to think, that they've got a chance of finishing sixth this season. I did have that conversation with a number of them after the game.
Yes, we noticed.
And got flamed, even though I'm right. But, yeah, they're not going to be teams that are challenging up there. Obviously, I suspect we'll end up a bit like Bournemouth at times. We may, if we can continue playing this football, we'll have games where we will batter somebody or threaten to batter somebody, but we'll also have games where we'll probably get battered ourselves.
No, Ross, I mean, Vicky just used the example of going away to QPR. Now, with the Albion, he's got a better class of personnel here, a better players to choose from. So, I mean, that obviously, that will that come into it?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think the fact that we've got a little bit, we've got a better, stronger squad now. So I think he can do more of that flexibility. Certainly, Houghton had a very rigid style about him in the Premier League era, at least. And it was all too predictable, easy to read. And he stuck with the players he knew, and that was that, pretty much. Whereas you feel that Potter not only has probably a little bit of a better squad now to work with, but also I think he's going to be able to use that squad a little bit more dynamically, shall we say.
Matt?
Yeah, and another thing that I've noticed that's different, and I hope continues the same way, is that we appear to be playing the same way away from home as we are at home.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't do that with Houghton. We changed completely. We went from sort of a fairly terrible defensive side at home to a truly atrocious defensive side away. And here we attempt to be doing the same thing, and I like that. I mean, I think if a team has a style of its own and it's playing away, why would you change it away? Why would you change it drastically away from home?
I mean, we've got Southampton today, but then we've got Manchester City the following week, and that's going to be the real test of to see where Potter Ball actually is. And it's actually going back to what Vicky said just now, that, you know, having conversations with fans who are a tatter on the deluded side. I mean, not that I'm accusing you of trolling them or anything, Vicky, but you do enjoy sort of hashtag teams like Brightoning them, don't you?
I think we all love teams like Brighton, don't we, to be fair?
Yeah. Yeah, with all due respect, it's ridiculous. I mean, West Ham, there is no way they've got... if they've got aspirations for to be a top six side...
their defence is awful.
Yeah, and it's pointed out time and time and time and time again. I think if we now have a weakness, it's going to be in individuals rather than the system, because we can see the system works. And like I say, as Matt said, once teams suss us out or know how to play against that kind of pressing game or that game that invites the press, then, you know, that's when we're going to sort of come undone. Southampton play a not dissimilar game, but it's going to be who's best at it.
Okay, well, let's have a look at last week's game against West Ham then. And Graham Potter's first home selection saw one change from the win at Watford, with Leandro Trossard making his debut in place of Jurgen Lacazette. Now,
Matt was doing cartwheels.
Now, Trossard was magnificent, frankly. Yeah.
Who's going to go first?
Go on then. Well, it depends whether you'd like to talk about Lacazette or Trossard. I'll talk about Trossard because it's much more positive. Mm-hmm. Anyone who went to the Valencia game must have scratched their heads at Watford when he saw that Trossard wasn't playing and Lacazette was. Trossard has really got something about him. You know, he scored twice last week. He should have scored more. He's got pretty much everything that we've been missing in a player in that position for the last few years. Lacazette
still Bambi on ice, isn't it?
Lacazette for me has never done anything to show that he's a Premier League footballer. Yeah.
Vicky?
Well, I think from what we've seen so far, and I didn't see the Valencia game, but to me, Trossard looks like, dare I say it, knockout with brains.
Does he look like sort of Lee Hendry Jr.?
No, well, it's Robbie Williams.
I just really hope, though, that, you know, everyone loved Knockhart, but the people that were, you know, agonising over him leaving, there were times last season when he really was a liability, and yes, he had those moments, but they were still quite few and far between.
Russ?
Yeah, I was going to say, completely agree with Vicky. That's absolutely spot on. Great player, and he's been great for us, Knockhart, but it was a bit hit and miss. Not quite as much of a team player, I think, as I suspect Trossard will be. I think he's got that more interactive, knitting things together type of element.
And of course, he was captain a championship winning side last year at Genk.
And also, he's also been hitting the ground running, changing leagues into the Premier League. Yeah. A lot of players do take time, Ricardo.
The point I was going to say about Trossard is as much as Matt and Vicky say he was magnificent, and he was his finishing, but there's certain aspects of his games that did worry me. I thought he was very weak in the tackle, and he was actually battered off the ball a bit too easily. He was, you know, and the reason I'm suggesting as to why Lacazette started rather than Trossard at Watford is because basically you need two battering rounds, and I think as soon as we saw against West Ham, Trossard was easily bullied off the ball in the midfield areas when he was fighting for it. He was just losing out far too often.
So obviously we don't know what the team's going to be today, but are you suggesting that when we go to Man City next week that Lacazette will come back in then?
No, I'm thinking actually we need someone with a bit more sort of pace and guile and movement. I don't think you need that. With Watford are a big sort of battering side, you know, and you have that kind of old English style of playing them. That's why we played Murray and Lacazette, and as soon as they came off, we scored with Andoni and Mopai, because we actually started being more mobile. But we needed that sort of, you know, where the defender's down a little bit. You're not going to be able to do that against Manchester City, so probably your best chance is to actually have players who are mobile.
Russ?
I don't know if the team news is, there's any news on that today yet, but I'm more likely to think that Lacazette possibly could start today because Southampton have got more of a Watford style defence.
Matt's going to start crying now.
I'm sorry, Matt.
Sorry, Matt. I'm not going to start crying, but to me it's absolutely inconceivable that you would have Lacazette in your team against anyone. As opposed to Trossard.
Yeah. Even Palace.
Anyone. You know, Trossard looks like, I mean, it's it's early days, but look, Trossard looks to be a very, very good footballer. Mm.
Yes, he does.
Lacazette looks to be someone who should not be playing in the Premier League.
Just to play devil's advocate then, what's Jurgen got to do for you to change your mind?
Be a footballer.
Scored 25 goals.
Perfect hat trick.
Of course, but then he'd have to do something regular. I mean, it's not his lack of goals. He just does not look like a Premier League footballer. And if you play Murray and him up front, you've got two people who struggle to play football up front. Mm. You've got two people who really don't play football.
Are you talking effectively that the Lacazette's strength, such as it is basically being a 6-yard sniffer in the style of Glenn Murray?
I wouldn't even go that far.
I don't know
what his strength is. I mean, if he has a strength...
I don't
if
think he knows, strength, that's the problem.
No, possibly not. But if he has a strength, it is merely that he is large.
Well, he's actually less large than he was last season, I think. Maybe it's just because he's cut his hair and shaved his beard, but he certainly looks a bit less large
just
than
if he did.
I mean, he did look a bit more mobile against Watford. That was my take on it than last season.
Well, let's go back to Trossard then. So, I mean, he started in that... I'm not quite sure what position he was playing, to be honest.
The point about it is, as much as we try and analyse it, and we're only two games in, the whole system is so fluid. I mean, the only thing that we know that's regular is the three at the centre-back. Apart from that, everyone's moving around everywhere.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Where do you think... Where will he end up? I mean, I can see him, certainly against certain teams, playing where Pascal's been playing, but he's found his form again a little bit. But obviously, Pascal's lack of pace against certain teams could be crucial.
It's against every team he's got a lack of pace.
Yeah. Well, this is true, but he's got the pace in his head, which counts for a lot.
Go on.
I think we're probably in for a season of, you know, changes from game to game. I think it wouldn't surprise me when you talk about who might start this week. It wouldn't surprise me if Andoni started up front next week at City. It would make more sense to me than, bless him, Lacazette. And I'm not quite as down on him as Matthew is. But, you know, I'm not suggesting he is going to be the saviour of our season. But, I wonder if Andoni might be the guy who starts next week. Maybe Mopai as well. Because, I mean, the thing with Mopai is he's hardly had any games. He didn't play any pre-season games for Brentford. He did train, but in terms of actually being up to speed with matches, he's probably a bit behind most people.
Mm-hmm. Okay, another player who most definitely caught the eye on Saturday was the tallest player on the pitch, which was Dan Burn. Now, Al, you've been purring about him, haven't you?
Well, when we saw him playing in the Cup last season, he looked very comfortable. He settled in straight away. And this is, admittedly, it's in a defensive team, which the entire sort of setup was built around. But now we've got these three centre backs, and the point, I know that you've been talking for a long time about having three at the back, and yes, now we've got that manager to change it. We just didn't have the personnel, and the system wasn't going to be done.
That's the whole point. Now we did have the personnel.
No, we didn't.
Because it's the same team that's starting.
No, because we've now got backup. That's the point. We didn't have backup before. So if you have, you need at least two centre backs as backup, which we now have. Last year we didn't. And not to the same quality. Don't get me wrong. Ben White is actually now doing very well at Leeds United. But was he the right player that we'd been needed last
year? So apart from the fact that we have Balogun and who went off and played the World Cup, he's did very well.
That's it. That's what we had as backup
in the Africa Cup of Nations.
Not a fan of Balogun.
And
no.
We also had Dan Byrne. So we did have the backup.
But Aidy, when Balogun played last season, another one that will always love him for the goal against Palace. Actually, he made a lot of mistakes.
Yes,
the games
he
that he did play, and
yes,
he conceded a couple of penalties.
Yeah.
And I thought. He's the one that will end up leaving, isn't he? If you know, whether on loan or something.
Well, possibly even this window.
Well, possibly, but it's
interesting. He's hardly played since Palace.
Mm. And even if Houghton had decided to go with three at the back, you couldn't see it. I think it would have been a step too far for him to change the whole rest of the team over. There were games. I think there was a game where we did actually have three at the back
against Chelsea,
and that didn't go terribly well.
That started bad. It was a problem there, wasn't it? So he didn't really have time to get it. But I'm not sure if Houghton really had a lot of trust in Byrne, maybe he's just a very cautious manager.
Well, the one player that we talked about, particularly at that point moment in time, I think we talked about it last week as well. That the one player in this three at the back that is. Possibly suspect is Duffy.
No, I don't think any of them are suspect. I think they all look absolutely fine. If there's a mistake in them, it's when it's an unforced mistake. I think all three of them look very comfortable. And the fact that Dan Byrne has slotted in so easily.
Oh my goodness, I think Al's wrong again. I think firstly the thing to say is that Dan Byrne coming in, as opposed to last year, Dan Byrne coming in here has come in and been the best player so far out of those three.
Yeah.
So that makes a huge difference. That makes a huge difference if your third player coming in is playing that well and that good. But the second thing is, I think we were talking about this earlier, I think it's absolutely right that the one whose position may be under threat is definitely Duffy. Not because he's not wonderful, but because he is less confident with the ball at his feet. And what teams are going to do, they're already starting to do it, is... whenever the ball's with one of the back three, they make sure it's Duffy.
Yeah, and not that the price tag should make any difference about whether they should be in the team or not. But I mean, you're paying over £20 million, which is a lot of money for us for a defender. At some point, we're going to want to put him in the side.
I think, Matthew and I, we had the conversation before this, and it's exactly that. I'm not suggesting, Al, that Duffy is suspect in inverted commas. I just think out of the three existing players who've got the shirts at the moment, he is probably the most vulnerable. We've bought, Potter was after Webster last season. He was looking at him. We know he was watching their games when he was a Swansea manager. Not that I suspect Swansea would have been able to afford him, but he was thinking forward. He was looking at him then, and he bought him in for a particular role. And I think in the long term, I'm not suggesting, far from it, that Duffy deserves to be dropped, but just in terms of playing that ball out from the back and being the most comfortable on the ball, Webster will probably at some point get in, and I think after the three at the moment, Duffy is the most vulnerable.
It's amazing how much someone's stock rises when there's a perception that someone else who's currently in the team is actually not playing as well as they could be. I have absolutely no problem with any of the back three at the moment, and I think they're worth their place. And we don't know, Webster's only, 12 years old. The price tag, as you say, is totally irrelevant. It's completely irrelevant. It has no meaning on this.
No.
Just something for fans to chatter about.
I think we were talking long term, really.
Yes,
we're not saying drop Duffy, but I suspect he's the most vulnerable in the long term.
Yes, it's not saying that the back three is in any way bad or suspect, or indeed that Duffy's playing badly, because he's absolutely not. It's a question of would a better ball playing centre back improve it? And the answer to that is probably yes.
Well, Russ, at some point as well, we're going to go to a four, I'd imagine.
Yeah, probably will do, yeah. And then it gets even more interesting to see who gets selected in those scenarios. I mean, I do think that the back three, as we've got, is first class defensively. As we said, the only question is possibly Duffy looks a little less comfortable playing the ball out. If we go to a four, it'll be interesting to see.
Okay, well, let's talk about a couple of bits from the game last week. And there was an early free kick, which with Glenn Murray actually being given a free kick, who knew? he was brought down midway inside the West Ham half. Gross fired in a delicious ball, and you found the head of Byrne, who just headed over.
That was a bad miss, and again, not convinced he wasn't offside, but that was actually a poor miss.
I think our good friends at Stockley Park would probably have been involved in that.
Oh, of course they were. They're involved in every goal. I mean, fast forward to our goal that was given. How long did they take with that? Or have you got that as part of your rant notes for later?
Yes, I have.
Surprise.
But I mean, one key thing which I've picked up on from watching the games and again watching the highlights back again is our quickness into the tackle, our turnover of the ball, and the ability to win the second ball this season has been fantastic.
But I think it showed on 85 minutes against West Ham. I think West Ham looked absolutely exhausted. I think, as someone pointed out, as soon as the final whistle went, a couple of the West Ham players just sort of like dropped to their knees. But Brighton looked absolutely, you know, knackered. You know, Dan Burn, believe it or not, was given the ball away by 85. They all look spent. So it's actually a very, very high press, high energy game. On a day like today, where it's actually quite warm, I'm just wondering how that's going to play out. Slightly worrying, actually. Mm.
Well, I mean, but obviously there will be probably water breaks at some point. But one of the players that's been...
No giggling.
But one of the players that's been kicked, like, in these turnovers is one that often gets a lot of derision from the Albion faithful, and that's Dale Stevens. And on Saturday, I thought he was fantastic.
I think in both the games so far, I think the two of them have done well. I mean, I would also talk about Proper as well, because I think in the... Proper was outstanding in the second half against Watford,
yeah.
And I thought,
yeah,
again, probably the second half against West Ham, it was fantastic. And
I mean, Proper
to me feels like, well, it's like having a new player. That's the old cliche, but it's like having a new player. It feels now that he's because he's been released or freed up or whatever it is. It now feels like he's the player that we signed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, Matt, last year I used an idea that the midfielders were like supermarket trolleys, that their wheels stopped when they went over the red line, and it's all of a sudden like the shackles have been released.
Yeah. My PSV supporting friend, who was so grateful for the LaCardia money, he's already been in touch with me saying that you know, we're now seeing Proper as he should be used.
Well, he's been playing like that for the Netherlands.
Yeah,
a bit further, you know, 10-15 yards further forward, so much more effective. Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong, a decent defender for midfielder, but his qualities are clearly in going forward.
Absolutely, and he's playing with greater freedom, which is the key, isn't it? It's just opening things up.
I think it also looks like, what it appears, you get it from the body language, is that the players appear to be enjoying themselves. The fans are certainly enjoying themselves, but the players appear to be enjoying themselves a lot more.
I'm going to come back to that point in a minute, Al, but let's just get on to this bit. Now, there was another foul. Glenn was fouled inside the West Ham half again, and Gross took the free kick again. Now, this is the one that did lead to the goal. Now, obviously, looking at the gut at this goal,
yeah,
was it the right decision? Yes, it probably was.
Objectively, yes.
Yeah,
but it's that horrible.
The argument, yeah, that is where the problem is, because if Burn was offside, he wasn't active in the first phase of play, but he picked up the ball in the second phase.
When he picked it up, it was still the first phase. That's the point. It's still the first phase.
But at that point, that's when the flag would normally have gone up.
And they've been told not to.
And that is where the problem is, because obviously we had that massive delay where we're all celebrating, yes, 1-0. What a fantastic finish that was from Trossard as well.
Yeah.
And a great ball from Burn as well. But I mean, he is getting... I did notice that Burn was going quite quickly. I mean, he's quite notable because of his size, I suppose. But
I know what you're saying is that, yes, it was. I mean, there wasn't a sec. Well, the second phase is when Burn touched the ball anyway. So, and you say it was a fantastic ball. It was, but I'm not sure he actually looked up to do it. I think he just hooked it back immediately because he assumed he had a West Ham player trying to swap shorts with him. So he just hooked it back in and it found Trossard and a very good finish. But it is irritating that... It's not so much it's irritating that the thing that he was given offside or not, which is annoying in its own right. It's the fact that the flag doesn't go up, and it's the play is brought back 15-20 seconds.
Well, West Ham were about to kick off.
Yeah.
And it was...
We're all used to the linesman's flag going up. That's the point, and being an active part of the game.
And that's where the joy-stealing comes in.
Yeah, I question your use of Glenn Murray was fouled, when what you mean is Glenn Murray earned a free kick.
Yes.
But
he's good at that.
Do you have the right to go down?
Pressure. Yeah.
But the VAR, I don't know, we haven't talked about this before, so I don't know what everyone else thinks.
Yeah, we've tried to avoid it.
Drives me up the wall.
I'm going to put my cards on the table, and I wasn't a fan. I wasn't in favour of it in the first place. Yes, there are terrible mistakes sometimes by referees, and they like to bang on about them on Match of the Day and on Sky incessantly, and this, you know, and they dramatise it and say, you know, this mistake has cost the team their place in the Premier League, or it's cost them the title. No team has ever been relegated because of one mistake in one game, and they conveniently ignore their own mistakes as well. Yes, they're awful bad. You know, look at the one that springs to mind is something like Joey Barton on Kyle, you know, years ago, and Stevens, all of these mistakes.
Which one by Joey Barton?
Well, yeah. I mean, how long have you got? But yes, we all want things to be right, but I just think it's going to end up being so sanitised. Yeah. And I also think, do you know what? Sometimes, especially when you're playing badly, you're playing badly, the stadium's a bit flat, and then the referee makes some kind of decision. He's clearly got it wrong, like he misses a foul or he gives a foul and it clearly wasn't. It gets the crowd going. Yeah. It winds the players up. Actually, sometimes when you're playing badly, you need a bad decision to get the game going again. And that's what football's... You know, it's that kind of...
And justified outrage feels good.
Justified outrage, exactly.
Dean used to actually have to rely on a poor referee being sort of utterly useless to get it going at some times. I mean, there's even a point in the game when clearly the ball went out over the touch line, over the dead ball line. Yeah. And linesman looking straight across it, said no play on.
Yeah, I mean Burnley, when we had the two players sent off, it was probably one of the best atmospheres we had at the Amex. Yeah. But what my view on VAR, I mean, I was fully in favour of the goal line technology when that came in. I think,
but that's black and white.
Everyone can agree that's good. But with VAR, I was in favour of the notion of it. I do think it's a work in progress, and I do think we need to persevere a little longer with it to see if we can get the time levels down.
Like 7 or 8 minutes, you mean?
Cause, yeah, exactly. Because that's the big problem, I think.
But Russ, the problem we've got with it is it's not necessarily the notion and the actual use of the technology. It's the fact that the laws are so antiquated that they weren't designed to be micromanaged in this way.
I think the problem with, as you said, the micromanagement is on the offsides, because that's too subjective. There's too much time needs to be deliberated over on those decisions. I think if you can get everything down comfortably below a minute, then I'd be in favour of carrying on with it. But I must admit, having seen it in action now this season firsthand for the first time, I do think it's taking too long. That was too long for the West Ham game.
Vicky,
I think some people thought, brilliant, we'll get VAR in and it's going to answer everything. But actually it doesn't, because a lot of stuff is still going to come down to good old human opinion. Mm. Look at, you know, I mean, well, West Ham have had two goals disallowed against them in two games.
Yeah, they're in favour.
And one of them one of them was like a shoelace offside. Even the handballs, to me, you know, when in the Watford game, the free kick that was fired at Glenn Murray in the wall, and unusually for Glenn Murray, he got his hands in the way of it. Mm. If that was against us, I would have been screaming for a penalty especially when they're talking about accidental handball being a penalty. You know, it's still human opinion, and therefore there's always going to be contentious.
Exactly,
it's
black and white again.
What is the best feeling at a football match?
Outrage.
Scoring a goal.
Exactly.
Or celebrating a goal.
Celebrating a goal. And even if you get it down to a minute, it is going to ruin that.
Mm.
Yeah.
It's like when they take a wicket in the cricket now, isn't it? And they take the wicket and they celebrate, but they're still kind of looking behind and looking at the batsman. And is he going to ask for the review? And
I mean, it's irritating enough
cricket,
when
it's black and white. Has he hit it? Yes, he has.
No, but you still have to wait.
It's not.
But I mean, with cricket now in the grounds, they're actually saying, right, okay, but they're actually discussing it and it's actually playing out.
It takes under a minute, but you know
exactly what's going on. You know what they're talking about. You know what they're looking at, and it's like, and you're actually seeing it happen.
It still doesn't improve. It still doesn't improve the visual spectacle of watching the game or going to the game. No. It might improve the accuracy of the result,
which is missing the point completely.
Yeah. Of the thing.
It's a human game. It's not a game done on spreadsheets.
VAR has been done to. It's because the big club. The managers, the Jurgen Klopp type people, they were the ones that squeal loudest for it, because they're the ones that with the biggest fan base globally, and when it goes wrong, when they get on the wrong end of a decision, which in Liverpool's case isn't very often, 10 million people worldwide complain about it. When it happens to us or to Burnley or to Bournemouth or anyone like that, no one's that bothered, are they? It's there to favour the big clubs and make sure they don't lose out.
But if you're basically I mean, if it is, as Matt was saying, the most irritating thing is irritating enough when you score a goal, start cheering, and then within 3 seconds you've just noticed the flag's gone up. Mm-hmm. That's irritating. So to wait for a minute now, as a part of me that admittedly I was sort of a bit squiffy when I mentioned this, but you know, hey, I might put it out there. Owls pickled when. We should have an outrageous protest of not celebrating a goal. Total silence until such time as you see the other team kick off. Then you go mad.
Good luck with that one.
I know.
I'd like to see people try that. If we got a 97th minute winning, in inverted commas, goal at Selhurst Park, I'd like to see people think, oh, I'll just hang fire for a couple of minutes while they decide.
It's a ludicrous suggestion, but... you're going to find that happens anyway.
Yeah.
You know, if VAR continues like this, people will stop celebrating when
yes,
the ball
they will
goes
just
in.
Sort of,
we
hang
do
on
it
a
now because we're yeah. conditioned to doing it. Well, we will become conditioned to not doing it.
Well, it's the first time it happened was for the goal, and I did half wonder if Dan Byrne was going to be offside, or whoever it was that connect. I did actually consider that because he was legging it for the ball pretty sharpish. He got there very quickly, and you think, well, okay, you know, you celebrate it. Okay, the flag's not gone up, and so you do it. It's the first time we've come unstuck against it. When you get the second goal, and they still take just as long to decide, and you think, when you think that person is possibly offside,
yeah,
and so you're going to consider it. But for the goal that was given, there was nothing. And they still took forever.
Because I thought Murray fouled him,
or he could have been, yeah. could have been
done for it.
But I mean, your thing, I mean, is right up there with the, there's an Italian side at the moment who are protesting against. I can't remember which side it is now, but they're protesting against lunchtime kickoffs on a Sunday, and their way of protesting it at a certain point in the match, I think 21st minute or something, they're all getting out a sandwich. that's their protest.
I can see that protest is going to have a massive impact.
It's going to
have
sandwich sales.
I thought you were going to say
they're
going to get the tables out and have a Sunday roast actually served on the centre circle.
That would be great.
That would be funny.
You know, get picnic tables out and tablecloths.
There's a serious danger of the culture. I mean, obviously, football culture changes bit by bit as life goes on,
yeah.
time goes on. But there is a danger of the culture changing for the worse. I mean, especially at grounds that have got a good atmosphere. I think the Amex is pretty good. We're quite noisy boys and girls, aren't we? And we want to keep it
it's
that way.
We're drunk.
Usually, yeah, most of us anyway. You know, that flatness. I've got a friend who said it's changing his opinion about whether he really wants to enjoy going to games anymore, whether he'll go to games anymore on a regular basis.
Well, those people, they still got, like, if they don't like it, they can go to grassroots football. Where,
it's always
where,
the championship.
Yeah,
yeah. True.
But, you know, say, someone known to all of us left at half time after the VAR decision last week and went to watch Skunk and Nancy up in Brixton, which he wasn't going to do beforehand.
Oh, right, yeah, it's okay. Well, are we going to mention him in a minute?
we might do, yeah. But let's just quickly just go through the rest of this. VAR was not involved in the West Ham opening goals. Well,
yes.
They looked
it was
it, of
involved.
Course.
They
looked,
yeah.
They're looking at all of them, but yes. There was no doubt about it, basically. And, yeah. And credit where credit's due. I mean, we can criticise the defence if you want, but that ball from Lanzini was delicious.
It was good. I was a little bit concerned about how much the Albion players moaned about it, but then I think there's possibly a sense of frustration born into it.
Well, that's where it comes from, isn't it? They're annoyed about our goal being disallowed, and they thought he was offside in their mind, so of course they're going to moan about it.
No, it was clearly onside. And I mean, he slotted it past Ryan, but could Ryan have done better, or am I being harsh?
You're being harsh.
So he did get a hand to
you
it,
always moan about Ryan when he concedes a goal. Every single goal.
No, I always always moan about conceding a goal.
Yeah, but you always blame Ryan.
No, I don't. Whoever
could
is.
Ryan have done better? Well,
yes.
At least we haven't got Kyle here anymore for you to beg to be brought
Absolutely,
in on every
yes.
single to every single
He's
time
only on
the midfield
loan. He
doesn't play
back.
Well.
He might be back. Okay, but we did finally get an equaliser, and Trossard he had many attempts to try and get himself a debut goal, and he did actually get one, and it was absolutely.
Go on, AD. How was it finished?
With a plum. But it was Gross.
That's a very good finish, actually.
Yeah, well, Gross hooks the ball forward towards Murray, but his run is blocked and the ball runs to Crossard. He still had quite a lot to do there, but he found the bottom corner and he got his debut goal. It was great.
So you reckon that they only looked at it because they thought that Murray might have fouled the defender?
They look at everything, don't
they?
They
look
at all goals.
But, yeah.
But I thought, yeah.
Because there's only three parts of that play, wasn't it? It was Stephen's ball forward.
I thought that they'd be looking at Murray fouling.
Oh, right.
It's like there's some school SWAT, isn't there? Sat in the classroom thinking, what can I find? He's sitting there congratulating himself on finding some minor.
Yes.
My other concern is how far back do you go?
Exactly.
How far back does, you know, how do you discern another phase of play? You could have a long
it's
passing
usually
move.
Usually when you win the ball back, I guess, isn't it?
Yeah, but
it
I just, you know, how far back does, when you look at a goal, when you're sat there, when you're the classroom SWAT sat there in that office of the FAs or the Premier League and they're going, right, how far back can I take this? That's the thing, isn't it? Someone somewhere this season is going to be on the receiving end of a decision that actually everyone else is going
set against VAR anyway. I hate it. If someone wants to invite me up to Stockley Park to try and prove me wrong, then fine. But
what's his name, Swarbrick, the guy who's in charge of it all, on TalkSport this morning.
All
right. He was telling us all how wonderfully it's going and that and the other, and I was thinking
he's
clearly not talking to anyone who actually goes to games.
No, quite. Yeah.
He lies like a cheap plastic watch.
Just give me good old fashioned Mike Dean.
Yes.
Especially Mike Dean.
But going back to Trossard thing and the discussion we had earlier about him, the thing and the difference between him and Knockaert is that Trossard makes good decisions.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. It's the decision making at a given moment, and Knockout will try and beat his seventh man. Rather than look up.
Knock out with brains.
Like, I mean, there was a chance for Morpay to...
he skied that, didn't he?
But it was a very difficult chance, to be fair. I mean, Murray did fire it and with quite some pace, but he had a lot to do with it. I mean,
I'd rather have a striker that's in the right place for it. If he misses some, so be it.
He did look particularly annoyed about it, didn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. You've got to be in that place to miss it. And we've had strikers in the past that haven't been anywhere near that place.
And we're getting players in the box, aren't we? We're getting a lot of touches in the box, a lot of chances, a lot of movements in the box.
It was 16 shots we had on Saturday. Yeah. Only four on target. West Ham had 8 shots and 3 on target.
I think that's more than we had between January and May last season, isn't it?
Probably was. Yeah. Okay, well, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online, radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. We are delighted to be brought to you in association with oldfootballshirts.com, and I'm just going to pass this over to Vicky just to have a quick look. And if you could just describe this monstrosity for me.
Well, it's a green and yellow... sorry, I'm not colourblind. It's a green and red shirt, almost with a sort of union flag type design on the front, possibly like a Maltese cross. I'm going to say it's probably Portuguese on the basis that there's something on the sleeve that says Portugal and possibly Portuguese sounding sponsors, but I have no idea beyond that.
It looks a bit like a rugby shirt more than a football shirt to me. Not sure I like this one.
It's Leicester Tigers colours, I think, if you're talking rugby.
It actually kind of looks like the Basque flag.
Is that a clue?
No, it's not.
it's Portuguese or Brazilian, actually. I'm going to say Brazilian.
No,
it's Portuguese. It's Air Portugal. Okay.
Well, this is what Phil Shirley from oldfootballshirts.com has to say about this particular shirt. He goes, here is your shirt of the week. And for no reason in particular, this is the 1999-2000 home shirt of Lustiano Samoa from the Saint-Maur-des-Fossés region in southeastern suburbs of Paris. Formed in 1966, initially the club consisted entirely of first-generation Portuguese immigrants. So there's your Portugal bit for you. Although they soon realised that they needed to recruit local players to expand. Los Lustianos play in the National Group A, which is the fourth level of football in France, and their home ground is the Stade Adolphe Charon, which can entertain 3,000 soft-cheesed enthusiasts. Thank you, Phil. In their relatively brief history, they've climbed the heights of the Championnat National to the third level of French football a couple of times, and they've managed to incur the wrath of the FFF after a failed merger with another local side, which ended up with them failing to register their side in time for the 2002 season, and they ended up being relegated down to the seventh level of football, the Division Supérieure Régionale. There you go. No one of any interest has played for Lustiano Samoa, although the wonderfully named Brazilian midfielder Wellington Dantos de Jesus turned out for the side a few times in 2014. There we go. Thanks for that. That is your shirt of the week. Obviously, lots more of those on oldfootballshirts.com. And Al is waving his arms around. Now, Al.
Hello.
Last week we had a competition.
Yes, we did.
And do you want to talk us through it?
Certainly did. Yes, we had Nick Outerside, author and journalist, and poet. He's got a new book out. It's Death in Grimsby, 50 Years of Following the Albion. And he had two copies to give away, unsigned, so they're going to be worth a fortune. But we asked a question: what club, apart from Brighton, do Glenn Murray and Kit Napier have in common? We asked you to email your responses to us. We have some respondees. Yeah. And
we've had a really decent response to this. So thanks to everyone who's entered. So I'm going to pass this over to Vicky. If you can just pull one of those
can
out.
Can you pull one of those out?
Oh, okay.
And we've actually had responses from all over the world on this one, which is fantastic.
Just read the name out as to who has
say
won.
Phil Shelley.
Yes.
He did not enter.
He's not allowed
Phil
to.
Phil Shelley!
I'll read it out.
Please do.
Karen Hasted.
Karen.
Hasted? Hasted.
Yes, Karen.
Congratulations,
Karen Hasted is in LA. Littlehampton.
Yeah. Oh. But so you win a copy of the book.
Matt, just could one you more? Drop another name for us, please, Matt? Yeah, it's like Swap Shop, this, isn't it? Without Cheggers.
And, Cheggers, please. Pop. Sorry.
Cedric Stone.
Cedric Stone
is in Toronto. Yes. So, Alex, if you're around, if you could come and see us, and you can take Cedric's book back for a but Cedric, thanks for listening all the way in Toronto.
Yeah. So, congratulations to you guys.
Yeah. So now, Al, we're playing Southampton.
We are. And doing these podcast things, we do get invited onto other teams' podcasts and videos and what have you. And Southampton have had one for a long, long time. It started as a fanzine as The Ugly Inside. It's now a video podcast. And we're delighted to say that, I mean, sadly only AD can hear him, but Freddie Hunt from The Ugly Inside is joining us.
Hi, Freddie. Can you hear us?
Hello. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm very well, Freddie. Now, thanks for joining us here on The Raw this week. Southampton start of the season, not great.
Yeah, typically slow start for Saints.
So whereabouts are you today? I assume you're going to be at the game today watching us.
Well, currently in the Basket Makers, just by the Basket Makers pub, just off the lanes. Fantastic little pub.
Yeah.
Fuller's, great ale, and in the sunshine.
I believe you were particularly keen to get involved in the Brighton Beer Week.
Yes, indeed, yeah. Some fantastic venues around the city got in touch, actually, when we were posting our sort of away guides. And we retweeted and we've been in touch, and there are some fantastic ales and craft beer all around the city this week.
And that's actually put on by our good friend Emma Inch, who has the beer and fermentation show here on Reverb, and is also the Beer Writers Guild Beer Writer of the Year, and she's put on a fantastic sort of spread over the coming week. I mean, you say it's Brighton Beer Week, it's actually 10 days. How good is that? I think it's sort of like a week plus a lock-in. But anyway, so you're in Brighton, inebriated, or sorry, slightly oiled already. Is there something about watching Southampton sober that just, you know, fills you with dread?
Well, so this game in particular, right?
Yeah.
I mean, to be honest, you know, Brighton started well this season. Graham Potter, as we were speaking actually, Al, earlier this week, you know, you said that Brighton are very much unrecognisable, I guess, this season under Graham Potter. But, you know, typically slow start from Southampton. And you know, we've seen sort of Ralph try and employ this high press, high intense sort of approach and tactics. So I think it could be a really open game this afternoon.
Sure. I mean, we were just saying on the show earlier how Southampton and Brighton are sort of very similar. I think you set up with a three at the back as well, don't you? So you've got this kind of high press from both sides. Yeah, it's either going to finish 0-0 and no one's going to get a chance, or it's going to finish 9-0, isn't it?
Well, to be honest, I think I'll take a point at this stage.
Yeah,
I don't think any game is going to finish 9-0 with VAR. at least 18 of those goals will be disallowed for someone's gonad being offside last century or something.
So what are you particularly looking at? I mean, you asked us earlier this week what we can expect from Brighton. What can we expect from Southampton?
So I think we'll see a reaction this afternoon. Obviously, two defeats on the board, no points. But as I say, you know, typically slow start. But I think we had an encouraging sort of last quarter or last sort of quarter of an hour of the game against Liverpool. So I think we can take some encouragement from that. And think we were millimetres away from a touch for putting the ball in the back of net to make it a historic comeback and make it 2-2 last weekend. But, you know, the first weekend, actually, in fact, you know, Burnley was severe disappointment, we struggled to adapt to the long balls. And I think, to be honest, if Brighton tried to adapt that game this afternoon, we may struggle against the attack of, Glenn Murray and Lewis Dunk up in corners and set pieces.
Sure. I mean, are you saying that your defence is kind of largely sort of big and static and sort of, you know, colossal? Or is it a mobile defence?
It's immobile defence, to be honest. Yeah. So, I mean, Vestergaard, the highest, the tallest player in the Premier League, can't head a ball, and he's about as fast as a tractor.
Yeah,
the tractor he is.
A tractor with three wheels. Yeah,
okay.
Getting Haaston-Hootle in was a bit of a coup for you last season. Obviously, he came with quite a big pedigree. Now you've had a bit of time to get used to him and his style of play. I mean, is there a particular style that he prefers? I mean, is it something that the Southampton public have bought into?
Well, I mean, to be honest, the first weekend, the first home game, he bought us all a beer, so he's already on side. and we've been there since December, since he signed up, you know. But we've seen him employ more than one sort of hand, if you like. I mean, he likes to recently line up with a 5 at the back or a 5-2-3 or a 3-4-3, depending on how we attack or defend. But he's certainly got more to the locker than sort of Mark Hughes, who was a robotic dinosaur on the touchline. You know, he had one philosophy and one tactics, and if it went wrong, we didn't know what to do. But Ralph adapts to the game, You know, I think a prime example last season against Bournemouth, 3-3, I think the both managers tried to change their tactics about four dozen times, and they, in the end, it was 3-0. So Ralph certainly got more to adapt and I guess proactively change the game plan.
Okay.
So we've got to crack on. We are getting to sort of the tag end of the show here. So, all right, you're in the basket, mate, because enjoying this brilliant city. The sun always shines anyway, so it never rains. So it might rain in Southampton, it doesn't rain here. Any ideas to how you feel that the game's going to go today?
Yeah, to be honest, I mean, we have these score predicting apps, and to be honest, this morning I logged in and I like to set my predictions early in the week, and I actually went for Brighton win, to be honest. But I have adjusted it now to a draw, so I think a score draw and a point on the board for Saints wouldn't be so much bad news.
Well, either Vicky next to me is being rude, or she's actually suggesting a draw as well. So.
Well, I don't know if I'm suggesting it, but I have a feeling that he was probably going to. I guessed that he was going to say a draw.
Yes, he was. He said a victory, and then he's changed it to a draw.
With the usual spivvy free kick from Ward-Prowse.
Yes.
It's a good job we don't do predictions, eh?
Yes, and we don't. Listen, Freddie, thanks for coming on to the Albion Raw. Enjoy the basket makers, enjoy the city, don't enjoy the football, and hopefully catch up with you later.
Great stuff. Thanks for having me on.
Not at all. Cheers, mate.
Cheers, Freddie. That was Freddie from The Ugly Inside. Now, Matthew, you got something to promote as well.
I have indeed. Thank you very much. Yeah, I'm in here today, actually, because I was outside filming a video for this...
is it a pop video?
It's a pop video. Okay.
Yeah, I know. I've been doing the rounds this morning, and I'm working on this thing called The World Transformed, which is a festival of radical ideas that goes on in Brighton from September the 21st to the 24th. And we've got some sports stuff, so I thought that's why I'd come in and talk. So I know some people don't like sports and politics mixing, but occasionally they do. So we're doing some stuff on trans rights in sport. We're also having a mixed five-a-side football tournament on the Sunday. There's a great session on the transformative power of sport at the Brighton Table Tennis Club, and then a table tennis tournament. And we're offering music, parties, art, poetry, politics right across the city for those 4 days. So if you're interested, get yourself along to theworldtransformed.org and you can find out all about it.
Okay. Well, we're not going to go on about this too much, but obviously...
When you talk about sport and politics, you can't not talk about this.
But last night, there was some good news.
Potentially. It's not gone through yet.
Yeah. I was speaking to Kieran Maguire about this earlier, who's off work. He was going to come on the show today, but he's actually working in Cyprus. So hello, Kieran. But I did speak to him briefly, and he said, I mean, my one takeaway I got from what he was saying was this is actually two cheers rather than three cheers, because it's potentially massive for Bury.
Right, I was about to say, what we're talking about here is Bury Football Club. They've got an owner called Steve Dale, who is probably Bill Archer on steroids. Really unpleasant character, wants to sell them down the river. Now the news last night that AD's talking about is that the EFL are reporting that a deal has been signed to sell the club. But what are the two cheers then rather than three? What's Kieran's concern?
Well, basically the fact is that the people that have been taking this over may actually be linked to Steve Dale.
Brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that came out yesterday, wasn't it, was that the only reason they got the CVA judgment through, the company that carried the vote, was owed $7 million by Bury. Their debt was bought by $70,000, and it turned out yesterday it was bought by the partner of his daughter.
So yes, it's all rather stinky, but I think that's the point that the larger point that we have to talk about across sort of football in this country, certainly, and we talk about football ownership and club ownership and what have you, is that 22 years on from what we went through, there was Maidstone, there was Wolves in the 80s before that. I mean, I remember talking to Wolves fans after we'd had our stuff, and they said, you know, we don't care about you because you never cared about us. We considered at the time that the Wolves thing was just this sort of really sloppy thing, but actually the fans were suffering. So when it came to Maidstone, when it came to Aldershot in the early 90s, when it came to us in the late 90s, we managed to garner a lot of support. And yet, like you say, I would say nothing's been learned. I don't think anyone wants to learn anything because of the nature of the way that football ownership is set up. In France, in Spain, in Italy, a lot of the local councils, the communes, they actually own the ground, they own the land, they have a vested interest
because it's a community asset.
In a community asset. Here, Matt, it's just not happening, is it?
No, it's not. But I mean, I think it's much wider. I mean, people go on about, you know, the fit and proper test and all the rest of it. And it's not that. It's that the economics of football is so screwed up that the only people who are likely to want to get involved
are people who are sort of financially insane in one way or another.
Mm. I mean, Tony Bloom.
At lower level, the clubs are very rarely make any money. So, I mean, it's...
I think the fit and proper test, though, I think people are under a bit of a misapprehension with that. And then they'll say with a lot of these club owners, well, how on earth could the Football League have allowed this? But all the fit and proper test is doing is it's checking for things like criminal convictions in relation to things like fraud. It's not going to stop someone who, just because someone's not been convicted of something, doesn't mean they're the right person to take over a football club.
No, well, I think Stephen, what's his name? He's got something like 20 failed companies.
The test that in Kieran's parlance, this is the way he described the fit and proper persons this week. He said, "No, question number one, are you a wrong'un? number two, have you got any money? And number three, is it your money?"
But then how do you, again, with a lot of these people, you can't know at the start of this, especially when some of these clubs, look at, there's numerous clubs over the years that have, these large-scale foreign investors have come in. Look at someone like Nottingham Forest, who they had that Fawaz, the fridge magnate, that's what they called him, isn't it? Because he had the refrigeration companies, the fridge magnate. He came in. And their fans welcomed him. Brilliant, we've got some money, we're on the up again, here we go. Didn't ask too many questions. All of those people that took over Portsmouth in the sort of mid-2000s, it's very difficult to trace where their finances are coming from. Look at, I can't remember the guy, Vincent Tan. Cardiff. Yeah. You know, again, brilliant, here we go, foreign owner, lots of money, we're on our way.
Let's change our colours.
And then it turned bad. So there's so many of these, and even someone like Palace fans were telling us when the Americans guys came in, here we go, we're on the up now, we've got these guys, they all want them out now because they perceive that they've done nothing but negative for their club, which is great, obviously, but and long may they stay, but these things are rarely as great as that, and actually tracing someone's financial history is probably quite difficult.
Yeah. But I mean,
I think that the onus, and this is where we get back to the EFL, the English Football League, this is where they are actually, you know, your original chocolate teapot. They are utterly toothless, utterly spineless. They don't have the wherewithal. This is the organisation that's supposed to be running football. Now, admittedly, the membership is the 72 clubs. So this whole notion of chairman voting against themselves. I mean, we talk about this fit and proper persons test. I think that actually it should be more the case that every single person who wants to come in and claim ownership or claim chairmanship should actually not just pass the test, but actually... The answer should be no until proved okay, rather than okay until proved no.
This is in an ideal world that might be really nice, but the EFL's position is surely that, given the economics of football, unless they allow some of these lunatics to take over clubs,
but it's not sustainable,
these clubs will just go to the wall anyway.
That but test you talked
there
about.
There is no one else who's going to come in and say, I am prepared to lose X amount of million per year on this.
That degree of diligence you just talked about, Al, that would probably come too late for Bury. If they had to spend a month investigating the finances of everyone that wanted the knight in shining armour that wants to come in, Bury would go bust by then.
But the thing is, if Bury go bust, and I really hope they don't, there'll be another club in a year's time, and another one, and another one, and another one.
They've predicted that 10 clubs will go in the next five years. We're trying to future-proof this.
Yeah, but then surely the way to change that is to change the economics of football.
That's my point.
It's not to say the EFL must enforce something.
That's all I'm saying is that the Football League must, if they're going to be guardians of the game at that particular level, they've got to look after it properly. I know that company law allows anyone to be able to do that, whereas I'm sure it does in France, Spain and Italy, but they have it in mind that actually there should be a lot more public involvement, council money. I mean, people here wouldn't necessarily be up for that because councils, all they do is not clear the bins.
But us fans are responsible for a lot of that economic pressure. There was a Bury fan on radio last week talking to someone on Five Live. He phoned in and he said, they got promoted last season, Bury, and they were paying... This chap said, Bury fan, he said, one or two of our players last season were on £8,000 a week. £8,000 a week. That's where their money is going because they've gambled and tried. I'm not saying, Bury deserve to go bust, far from it, but if clubs are allowing themselves to do that, then that's why they end up in trouble.
Just one other final thing on that point was with Portsmouth, chatting to Portsmouth fans when they came down for a game, I was asking them in the pub, would you have given up the cup run for stability and have kept your dignity and kept your finances in order. And he said, no, wouldn't have given that up for anything.
Yeah. So you've got they to were have playing Johnny Tarker 80 grand a week, though.
Yeah, exactly. But there's some responsibility with some of the fans, as you said, some of the fan
sign
pressure.
Sign more players. But, yeah. You know, we're lucky in that respect.
Well, let's move on for that. I mean, we wish Bury all the best of luck, obviously. They're a community club. We know what it feels like to nearly lose it, and we're hoping that they can maintain
But the issue should always be that we as other clubs' fans are happy to help them, but we're not helping the club, we're helping the fans, we're supporting them. Mm. So we've got to hear it from them.
Okay, well, Russ, before we finish, obviously you are chairman of Seagulls Over London. You've got a special guest coming up.
We have. Yeah, I should correct you. I'm actually membership secretary of FABS.
Yeah, chairman.
Roger Bevan's the man.
King. You're the king.
Do you have a throne?
We have got a very special guest coming up.
Well, just tell us what Seagulls Over London is first.
First of all, yes, it's a social meeting group, basically, bi-monthly, roughly speaking, for fans who are living or working or just in London and can come along to our social events, and we get guests from the club or related to the club that come up and give us a chat, and we meet up, have a drink and get to meet them. Our next guest is Alan Munnery, who's coming up on the 26th, I think it is, of September, Thursday 26th, which is at the Sir Christopher Hatton pub in Chancery Lane, which is our main new meeting place near Chancery Lane station, and we're expecting a big crowd for that one. So if anyone's interested, look at us.
And how do they get in contact with you, Russ?
Well, best bet is to go to the website, which is www.seagullsoverlondon.com. There's an email address, which is mine, actually. sort of. Well, it's the group's one. Communications man. So if you want to get in touch to find out about that and whether you can get tickets, it is £5 for non-members to come. If you are a member or you wanted to become a member, then you can get in effectively for free, minus your membership free, obviously. Uh-huh. But it's going to be a big event. I think we expect it to sell out. And things are going well in general. Membership's up 60 plus, and we've had some good guests like Paul Barber and Gordon Smith on recently. Mm. And we've got a few others coming along in the future, potentially you guys, in fact.
Yeah. All you have to do is ask, you know. Yeah. But we'll do anything for a pick, whatever you're
applying. The thing is, Russ, I remember when Seagulls Over London was exotic to us, but you know, we got Seagulls Over Toronto in last week, and you know, it was.
I know.
So if there's anyone from Seagulls Over Uzbekistan or something.
Just thinking Seagulls Over Marseille or Seagulls Over, you know, sort of Barcelona.
If they want us to come and go, that'd be nice.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
Seagulls Over Rio.
There's Mile High Seagulls, which is a guy in... it's not what it sounds like. He's in Denver, Colorado, which is Mile High. And so big up to Amir. He's got his own little thing going on over there as well in the States. Maybe get him over for a chat
absolutely.
On the radio.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, that is it. That is all we've got time for this week. So thank you to everyone. Thank you to Matthew Potter. Thank you to Vicky Reese. Thank you to Russell Guyver. Thank you to Alan Wares. I've been Aidy Packham. And as we mentioned before, we've got to wish all the best to our friends at Bury. And this is Quebec.
Shake it off.